Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 3 of season 10. I've been using Boris FX products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we speak with Hilda Rasula, ACE, about editing American fiction, which won the AFI's Movie of the Year Award and was nominated for a Spirit Award, a Critics' Choice Award, a Golden Globe, and the PGA for Best Picture, and could be on the list for the Oscar. Hilda's previous features include Moving On, Vengeance, French Exit, and the TV series Our Flag Means Death, among many other projects. Before I hop into our discussion with Hilda, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optix, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Hilda Rasula, ACE, discusses editing American fiction. Hilda, it's so nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me. I loved American fiction. I can't wait to talk about it.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I love your podcast.
Thank you. How did Cord find you? Please tell me that it wasn't that you edited another movie with a writer in it, Vengeance.
No. He did not read based on that. I know. No, Cord found me through really the traditional routes. I got a call from my agent, as normal as could be, saying that there was a good script floating around and she was going to email it to me. She didn't mention his name though. And we got off the phone and I looked in my inbox and there was Cord's name sitting in my inbox. And I realized, oh my God, I know Cord socially. We did not know each other very well at all, but we had a few friends in common, including one very good friend who used to be his editor when he was a journalist, like his magazine editor. Our good friend Anne, we had in common. And so it was one of those funny, odd things of, oh my God, right. I had heard at least a year ago that Cord was developing a movie and he was maybe going to direct a movie. But there's a lot of people who are writing a script and you never know if it's going to get produced. So he really sort of made good on that. And suddenly there was his name and there was his script. And I opened it up right away, of course, and just started reading and knew within, I don't know, 15 pages, I want to do this movie. This is exactly the right kind of vibe for me.
How did collaboration work between the two of you? He's a first-time director and you're an experienced editor.
It was great. Cord is super collaborative, maybe because he was a first-time director. First of all, we really did have the foundation of a really strong script. And I think that really helps. Cord also really knew the tone he was going for. He knew the kind of movie he wanted to make. He didn't have the benefit of a kind of film school graduate's knowledge of film grammar. So that kind of changed how we could talk about things. He really, really was coming to it as a writer, a writer's writer. And I think that he had such a handle on the tone of the movie that he wanted to make and why he was making it, which I think is really invaluable. I think when filmmakers, they might like their story or their script, they think it's amusing, they're proud of it, of course, in various ways. But I think there are times when there are filmmakers or even TV makers who they don't really know why they're telling the story. Cord knew that from the inside out of his very being. So that really helped us sort of control the tone and know what we were going for and have these gut checks about like where we were swinging too far one direction or another. He really honestly was amazing at just letting me do my thing and getting out of my way a lot of the time on when it came to some of the nuts and bolts of cutting. He really respected what I had to say and listened to me. And, you know, when I had an instinct about, I really think we should do this, or let's wait and hold off on that wide and to use it only as the last shot of the scene, he just really was incredibly open to and for the most part loved my ideas. And so it was like a dream collaboration.
I loved the efficiency of the first act, especially. It really hustles along. You get right into the story. There's not a lot of fat in there. Is that the way it was scripted?
No, it wasn't. I mean, with some changes. One of the first big decisions we made to change was that we decided that we needed a new scene two. So that was a major sort of different element. There was a much slower scene originally in the script. Scene two, as it ended up, is a rewrite and a reshoot that we did at the very end of the process, where Monk gets in trouble with his colleagues at his academic job. And he basically has to face the consequences of his actions, of his grumpiness and intolerance.
Rashness.
To, yes, his rashness, some of his behaviors, and is forced to go back to Boston, which is where his family is. And motivating him getting to Boston and finding a way to get him there with maximum sort of upping the stakes and then adding in more jokes was really the purpose of the rewrite. So I think Cord did a great job of just sort of tweaking that whole way to get him off before we even go to main titles. And then he's on his way and he's forced to go back home. And then the other big change that happened pretty late in the game, it was a restructure that I thought of, and I really was kicking myself that I did not come up with it sooner, I'm embarrassed to admit. But after months of cutting, finally, we were struggling with this idea of what is the proper way and the proper pace in which to meet Monk and understand his central beef about the publishing industry, about culture, about the way Black literature is received. This is sort of what he struggles with emotionally and professionally. And it was a very drawn out introduction to him. We met him, he went back to Boston, and then we had many scenes where we met his family. We met his sister, his mom, Lorraine, their housekeeper, who's really another member of the family. And we set up these other family drama plot lines. And then we finally met Issa Rae, who plays this character, Sintara, whose work is sort of endemic of an issue in publishing that Monk particularly hates, basically. Although she's not in all that many scenes of the movie, she's crucial. I mean, she's like a really crucial turning point to understanding what his central problem in life is. And we met her pretty late in Act One. And that was always an issue. I mean, we kind of knew it was always an issue. But, you know, you have a board in your room with index cards and all of that. And every way that I tried to move around the cards, it always messed up the timeline and the narrative in some way that never made sense. And I was like, well, that can't happen there because then this happens. And then, you know, you could tie yourself into these knots and you think that you've hit a brick wall. And it's unchangeable. And then finally, extremely late in the process, I suddenly realized that sometimes it's like you just have to do what the film wants. What the film wants is to understand what he's all about and to meet Sintara earlier and to completely solidify that professional foundation of his cultural complaint before you can move on to really meeting his family. I mean, I felt at least that's what the film was really looking for. And then I just finally saw a new math to it and a way that could be done. But in order for it to happen, we had to kill some darlings. And that was a little sad.
Kill some darlings.
Yeah,
yep.
You know, there were other scenes that had to be sacrificed for the timeline to make sense. But it sets up the right foundation for Monk. And it was just necessary in the end. We just had to do it. It just worked when we did it.
I love the idea that editing is a process. And as much as you might say that you're embarrassed because it took so long to figure out, you figured it out. and before it came out in theaters, yeah. You know, sometime between when it got shot and when it came out in theaters, you figured it out. And that's all that matters. Doesn't matter if it's the last day or the first day, but.
Yeah. And, you know, thank you. That's a really, I should remember that, that editing is a creative process. You have to sort of get in the mud of it all and get messy. And it doesn't mean that you have all the answers right away. That's not what being creative is. Sometimes it is at the 11th hour.
You almost can't expect it to happen at the beginning. Like those answers, you need to live with it. You need to go, you know what it feels like? It feels like this should happen earlier. And that takes, it just takes time and it takes patience.
Yeah. I think, you know, there is that classic kind of adage of there's three times that a movie is written. There's the movie that's written on in the screenplay. There's the movie that you shoot. And then there's the movie that you cut. And that's the final rewrite. In this case, Cord's script was pretty damned brilliant. But there are things that you can't possibly know until you feel it as a human and as an audience member, really, until it's finally on screen in front of you. And that's when you're getting into the real struggles of, like, you know, you're doing this ultimately for an audience, not for yourselves. You're trying to create an experience that's about sound and music and images and how that feels for an audience. So there's so much instinctive stuff that happens at a level that sometimes even, yeah, it's hard to articulate. You just know that there's a feeling that something is wrong in this area of the movie. And then it's your job to, over the course of, yeah, months, eventually diagnose it is even the first problem and then heal it. Yeah, it's a process.
Editor as doctor. I like it. Okay. Speaking of diagnoses, after the diagnosis of his mom gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but there's a little montage immediately after the mom is diagnosed that as Monk hatches his plan. Can you talk about cutting that little montage?
Yes, that was a really fun thing because that was one of the only moments when we had time. It was a quick shoot. And they were squeezing in a lot of location shooting. And some days they had multiple company moves in one day. It was a very tight schedule for them. But that was one of the few times when we actually had the time in advance for me to say, I have a wish list of things I want you to shoot for this. And they did it. And they got me my wish list. It was so special and wonderful. And I just said, this has to feel different. So there needs to be like extreme close-ups and isolated shots of the typing in his eyes. And we need to feel his agitation in some way, you know.
Glass of scotch, I think.
Yeah, a glass of scotch being tossed back. That was one of the few cases of just of me getting to kind of order up some shots that I wanted. And they did it for me, which was so wonderful. It is such a turning point for the movie. And so there needs to be something that is different than just some of the types of close-ups or mediums that we've been living in, you know, or medium wides. Like there needed to be something that really felt like something was afoot, whether he realizes it or not, because he thinks this writing thing he's doing is really sort of a dark personal joke. But as an audience, we need to feel that a larger plot is being set in motion. We don't really know it consciously yet, but we need to feel it. And there needed to be a little montage and the style of shooting needed to change for a second.
Very cool that you ordered that up. I love that. There's a scene where the characters that Monk is writing about interact with him.
Right.
Because of the artifice of the scene, there's imaginary people in the room with him. Was there a trick to editing that, or did you edit it like, no, it's just a conversation between three people?
Part of the trick happens through the initial camera work, the first dolly move that starts on his laptop, his fingers are typing, and then it circles around and pulls back and reveals the characters in the room with him. So really, that was a very designed, it was written on the page that way. And then our DP, Christina, helped Cord to just sort of design how they were going to be revealed, which was great. Of course, as with everything, you know, in editing, there was a little like reframing we had to do because the characters got revealed too early in a way that didn't look right. So of course, as with everything, there's massaging. But yeah, I love how that dolly move just reveals them. Then it really was just a matter of cutting it like a slightly heightened drama. But I think the drama, the dialogue happening between these two fictional characters that are in front of you that have materialized is really engaging, actually. I mean, the actors are great. And so you actually find yourself getting kind of caught up in this mini father-son drama that's happening on screen, even though you know it's fictive. And then there was just a little bit of massaging we needed to do to track Monk's emotions. We repurposed some shots and reordered things slightly just to give the sense that Monk was enjoying this writing process, that he, you know, that there was this sort of dark humor and demented joy to what he was doing, you know, that he was amusing himself with this thing. But I mostly just cut it like a dramatic scene. And then in the sound design, we certainly played with that, because we created a whole thing with our sound designers to have a heightened urban soundscape that didn't go fully as deep as you would do if you actually had just cut away and seen that scene happening before your eyes, you know? I mean, it's definitely there and you very distinctly hear it, but we didn't go as far as we maybe would have if we were actually seeing the real scene play out before our eyes, because they're still standing in this room. So it was a weird balance that we had to play with. And then, you know, there's a character that breaks the fourth wall at a certain moment, and we did sort of drop out the sound, that urban sound design, and we played with that a little bit. So yeah, there was the playfulness. We wanted to make sure that the audience knew that there could be some laughter and enjoyment to be had with the creation of this story and these characters. But, you know, we actually also had a very funny debate at one point about that scene, which I loved, by the way. I mean, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, hands down. But we had this funny debate about, are the actors too good? It's hard to tell. Is it supposed to be a well-written book or not well-written? Is it, Monk himself disdains it, but he's also an artist and an intellectual. And clearly, we are told, a wonderful writer in his own way, even though he writes these really inaccessible esoteric things, but he still is a great writer. So does an artist, even when they're doing something as a joke, do they accidentally put some of their own artistry into a bad joke? I think they do. I mean, my interpretation of our wonderful actors in that scene is that they're engaging and great in a way because Monk can't help but put some of himself into it. And there's shades even of, you know, this absent father figure in the movie. Monk's father is not in the movie very explicitly, but it's like he comes out in that scene, in this father-son scene that Monk is writing. So Monk puts himself in that. Whether he, as much as he disdains it, he can't help but put a little bit of himself into that, which I think contributes in the end to the runaway success of this novel.
You mentioned the sound design, and I saw that you were on the Tonebenders podcast, which is a podcast that I love. I thought that was very unusual because, of course, there's sound design in this movie, but this isn't like a movie where that like punches you in the face, like it needs sound design. You know, it's not like a war movie or a superhero movie or something that has science fiction that has tons of sound effects. So talk about the value of the sound design that you did in the offline and that the sound designers did to tell the story.
Yeah, my assistant Charm was really instrumental in helping build all of the temp sound design. Scene by scene, we would talk about every single scene and what, you know, what we thought it should be and what needed to be cleaned up about it. It's a movie that, to be honest, in the offline, there was just a lot of cleanup work because they were shooting on location. There's many scenes that take place out at the beach house or in the beach town.
If you've never been in a beach town, there's a lot of noise.
There's so much noise. They did a great job recording it, considering, but there was a lot of cleanup that had to be done. And it was, and the beach, Monk's beach house is this old house that has these incredibly creaky floors too. So it was really like a whole thing that we had to deal with. It was a lot of work to clean it up. And then of course, once you've cleaned it all up, and then you have to artfully add in all the waves. One of our sound editors had cleaned it up so well by the time we got to the final sound edit that then I was like disturbed. And I was like, no, wait a second. You have to put back in some of those floor creaks, like at least a few of them. This is an old house. This is a family that's in decline in a sense. You know, the mother is certainly, her health is in decline. Their finances are in decline. This cannot be some kind of well-built house. You need to put some of that back in. So it was a very funny thing of us going back and forth about that. We are so lucky because we had this great team. Our mixers, Alex and Rich, were true artists. I mean, Alex worked on Everything Everywhere. There's other things they know how to do that are much more intense than a movie like this. But I think with this, it's really about making sure that the characters' voices were crystal clear. Ultimately, this is a talkie, and the actors all have just gorgeous voices in different ways. And we really wanted to make sure that every joke landed, everything was clear. That was the kind of foregoing concern. And then when in those moments, like when he's writing the novel or at the end, I don't want to spoil it, but there are opportunities for more playful or more interesting sound design when we start to get playful about the concept of storytelling. You know, when the movie itself starts to move into a zone that's not straight kitchen sink drama or comedy. So there were opportunities to play. There's many movies in this one movie.
For most of the scenes, it felt like you were getting in, you know, the classic script writing advice of getting into a scene late and getting out of a scene early. I thought that was definitely true with this movie.
Right.
In a good way. Can you talk about your role in getting in and getting out compared to the way maybe it was written?
First, I do want to credit Cord for being an excellent writer, because he, through his all of the amazing television shows he's worked on and writers' rooms he's been in, I think he automatically has this great writer's muscle for understanding that. So he writes scenes relatively efficiently, or he understands, you know, how to do that. But then, of course, we really did do a lot of, yes, trying to see how late can we enter this scene and how early can we get out. We had exactly those discussions all the time, or, you know, dropping couplets, seeing what we could get, what we could lose and have the scene still hold together. It was a script that reads in a very like fun with a lot of verve on the page. It's sort of punchy and fun and interesting. And then like everything, once you see it on screen assembled, it's much more languid. And some of the ideas were getting a little diffuse, I guess, for lack of a better word. You know, once you've gotten in there and you've kind of made what is either your central intellectual point or comic point or whatever the dramatic point, I found that there were scenes that were overstaying their welcome. So then we did, there was a whole stage of the edit in the kind of, you know, the middle of the edit when we did a lot of work of scaling back scenes and carving them out. And I try to pace as I go, you know, even in my very first assembly, I try to pace up the actors and certainly for comedy, I do a lot of that, really controlling the rhythm of the dialogue. But we had to really roll up our sleeves and do some of the work that's necessary to make scenes stand on their own and not be indulgent. We just never wanted to bore the audience. That's not what this movie is for. This movie is really supposed to be a genuinely entertaining film. We tried to hold ourselves, you know, to just like a rigorous standard. And I think, again, because of Cord's training in the TV world, he was amazingly disciplined about doing that. He really was shockingly good about that. For a first-time writer-director, they tend to hold tightly to their words. He was pretty good about letting me get the hatchet out.
I love the choices in the scene where Thelonious decides to change the title of the book. They're on the phone with the publishers, and they've got the book named one thing, and the publisher's all excited. And to derail the whole thing, he decides he wants to call the book something that cannot be published.
Yes.
I loved the choices of when to be on who throughout that scene.
Oh, thank you. Those scenes, I mean, that one in particular was so fun to cut. The actors who play the publishers, who are kind of, we assume, in some high rise on Madison Avenue or something like that, they are gifted comic performers, and they actually did a lot of wonderful improv that was so fun and great. And that ultimately we also had to sort of ended up on the cutting room floor, just not because it wasn't good, but because we ultimately had to take seriously the idea of who do you want to be on when, exactly what you're talking about. What creates the maximum impact for the comedy? I mean, the rhythm was one thing. I realized as well that to pace it up to a kind of slightly more screwball level that I thought we should get at, it was important to sometimes use Monk's face and be on him listening to the publishers a little bit more. So because that just gave us a lot more flexibility in terms of tightening the dialogue and really, really tightening the screw until it was kind of like as tight as a drum for comedy's sake. And then Monk's face is also so great. I mean, Jeffrey can do such stillness, but he can do it in a way that a little look in his eye or a little curling of his upper lip or something seems to say so much. So he was sort of a great, great man as well in those comic scenes. You could cut it with an even balance, but if it was cut too evenly, it actually felt wrong. The scales need to swing more in Monk's direction. so that we were still understanding that he was kind of anchoring the scene with his face and his looks. And we understood then just how absurd, this crazy, absurd merry-go-round going around him, almost rotating around him. He had to be the center of that. And so that affected the balance of, yes, when we were on, who, at what time. It worked as this kind of like baseline that you could, you know, cut off dialogue and shift the rhythms a little bit and tighten things running underneath him as he's listening. But then it also works sometimes as these like short little reactions too, that worked as the, almost like in jazz music, the way you'd have like a trumpet doing like a shot note, you know, like this little like off rhythm thing. Jeffrey just, he can be used in all ways, basically. He's just so wonderful.
And I love the cut to his agent when Jeffrey says, I've got this idea. It was perfect place to be. I just wanted to see the agent at that moment, and that's what I got to see.
Yeah, that's so good.
How much do you find you want to sculpt performances, pacing especially? You talked a little bit about that, you know, making it tight as a drum. And how much do you rely on the natural rhythms? Or does that change over the course of the edit?
I think it changes a little bit over the course of the edit, but for me, I tend to work a lot upfront with pacing, like just even in assembling, even in my very first cut of a scene, I work hard to take out some of the things that feel extraneous or wrong. I mean, obviously I won't start counting lines or anything yet, but it bothers me unduly when the rhythm feels off and if it's too loose. I mean, when I'm watching dailies, obviously I'm especially with an actor like Jeffrey, I'm paying attention to the rhythms of what he's giving and the looks in between, and to understand that some of those rhythms are important to follow. But following just a sort of general natural rhythm, no. I think it's better if you manipulate it. I just think it is. It's better for comedy. It's better for juicing the drama. You get such wonderful gifts from actors. You just have to watch their eyes and their faces and all the little moments to shine a spotlight on each perfect little nugget of gold that you're given. This means that you do end up really using some elbow grease in pacing. It's really a matter for me of almost like, I love the actor's look there, but then I also love what the other person is doing in this moment and this. And so it's really a matter of just trying to squeeze in all of my favorite things and then somehow make it feel natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the trick for sure. Macro pacing, what was the first cut lengthwise? I don't know how many scenes you cut out or any of that stuff, but I would think with this kind of a movie, there could have been more scenes with the brother or with the girlfriend. They could have gone out on another date. He could have gone to see his mother in the nursing home again. You know, who knows? What happened there?
I think our first cut was 2 hours and 28 minutes. That was not including credits. So we cut out more than half an hour. We omitted 11 scenes. So for a movie of this sort of scale and shape, it was kind of a fair bit. Again, Cord and I were just really wanted to try to hold ourselves to a strong standard of, first of all, how long we thought the movie should be overall. We were adamant that it was not going to be a movie that was over 2 hours long. It didn't feel right for this film. And really, some of those scenes were wonderful. I mean, Cord and I each had our kind of little babies that were different at different moments. We were each, you know, fighting for, and we would have these really intense discussions about why to cut. Some went right away, of course, which is normal. But yeah, we had a lot of discussion with our producers as well about what is the value of a scene. Ultimately, you get into these deep philosophical things of, does the romance hold up without this extra bit? Does this long philosophical speech that Monk has on one of his dates with Coraline that reveals a little bit about him as a writer, which is nice and is interesting, but is also a long speech when maybe it comes at a point in the movie where we already understand who he is as a writer. Is that really necessary? So these are the types of things. And then slowly over time, making the decision to axe things, basically, you know. Mm-hmm.
Did anything go for a while and come back?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yes, one thing that went and we experimented with was just a tiny scene, but where he's in his hotel room watching a Hollywood TV and a Hollywood movie, and it's making a sort of cultural critique. That was definitely one where we talked about cutting it. We wondered if we even needed to make that, if it was clear enough what Monk felt about things. But Act One ended up getting, as you said, into such a kind of tight pace. It really does roll along that there were a couple scenes like that in Act One where we decided to actually put them back. We just experimented. We were like, what would it be like if we took this out? And we lived with it for a little bit like that. And then we ended up putting them back in because we felt like it was laying track that ended up eventually being helpful later.
It's so much about his problems with the cultural aspects of these books is that it's all books. And so I thought that was a good scene because it was showing that this cultural representation of Black people is not just in novels. It's everywhere.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think it is true. It's important to kind of broaden the target, basically. Eventually, with meeting the Adam Brody character as well, it's not just the book publishing industry that ends up being critiqued anyway. So yeah, I think that's important. And then we did have that other scene after he's written the book, when he gets the phone call from his agent. There's a little short montage that's definitely about as absurd, I think, as we get in some of the comedy, but where he's watching a promo on television for Black Stories Month. And I mean, that gets into a zone that's like, obviously gets quite absurd of tone, but again, laying the track for what's going to happen later with the Adam Brody character. I think it's important to do some of that. I think that was the last scene that we locked because of clearances. It's very short, but it was very tricky.
I figured that was just made up.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. No. Those are all real movies. Yeah. So that was a tricky thing for our poor producer, Nikos. Really had to sweat hunting down actors, widows, from movie, you know, I mean, it was that kind of situation. It was a bureaucratic nightmare for him. But Cord and I were pretty happy with what we ended up with.
The movie is based on a book. Mm-hmm. Did you read the book?
No. I don't like to read the original source material until later. I read the book this fall after we'd already finished the movie. I really just wanted to have Cord's screenplay being the guiding thing. I think it's possible for me to get sidetracked by reading something in the original novel that doesn't need to be there in the screenplay and getting almost distracted by it, or getting razzle-dazzled into thinking, oh yes, I see all these themes and they're there in our movie too, when actually maybe they're not, and maybe you have to work harder to elucidate them. So for me, at least, it's better if I just don't read the source material.
I did a movie based on a book, and I was the only person on the team that didn't read the book.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And there was all kinds of things that everybody else knew about the plot and the storyline that I didn't. And I'd be like, well, why does this happen and this happen? And they're like, well, because of this. I'm like, that's not in the script.
Yeah, it can trick you, actually, into thinking that a character's motivation is there when it's not. People who have read something, they're connecting dots that might not be there for the audience who isn't. And you have to cut the movie for the audience who hasn't read the book. Then it's just a rich, interesting experience for anybody who has. That's not actually the main audience of the movie. You have to think about them.
There are some nice little montages that indicate passages of time, but not all passages of time had nice little montages. What indicated to you that there should be a longer transition? And when you can just jump, we're just going to jump time in a single cut and it's going to be another day or a month later or whatever.
There were a few cases in the script where Cord had just done that. There's like a little time cut that happens in the script, which is great. I love it when that's built into the writing, that there's a kind of slingshot into the next moment or scene that is a little bit later, but you can just fill in the gaps. So in some cases, that was Cord's own doing. And in other cases where we did build in more montages or needed to stretch out time, that was not there originally. And that was sort of just a feeling that we had, you know, working through the film, of realizing that we actually did need to build in a montage. We did need to stretch out time here and there. And then in some cases, some of those more kind of elliptical things were those cases of some of those 11 scenes that got cut, you know. And sometimes that provides the cut for you, you know, just a scene goes away and you have this interesting little jump to another moment. Sometimes it just doesn't work, but sometimes it does, and you're delighted with the way you're just propelled forward in the story. So we had a few of those in this movie that I thought it was great. You know, we were like, ooh, that's great. And suddenly we're here, ready for another fun scene with Arthur.
We already kind of talked about this, but I want to get more of a sense of your feeling for how much of something to have, which was juggling the time spent of the main plot of Monk in this book with this lovely drama of his family, mm-hmm. which was also very meaningful, lovely, cinematic, but
yeah,
that's not the story, you know. How do you decide how much of one and how much of the other?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think it's up for debate, first of all, as to whether that is the story or not. The log line is the satire, for sure. It's the professional book storyline of that Monk is having. But I think that the other thing that's going on with this movie that Cord really wanted to do is to tell a family drama, and there's romance and drama, and, you know, family drama and sibling relationships that tell a story that is incredibly relatable, that is about a Black family, that is just a story that we don't often get to see on screen. I mean, it's a sort of part of the central critique of that the movie is trying to make, at least, which is the projects that get greenlit are so often period pieces about a very particular time in American Black cultural history, or just very particular characters or dramas. And Cord quite explicitly wanted to subvert that. So I do think both of these storylines to me are of equal importance, but it did provide a real quandary sometimes of how to juggle them, how to checkerboard them, how to do that, because so much of the edit actually was really struggling to figure that balance out of what is the right rhythm and tone of how to achieve the movie that we wanted to achieve, but for a while it seemed so far away, you know? If you go too far into broadness in the comic scenes, you start to step into a version of the movie that you cannot get back to that family drama properly. It just starts to swing out into this direction that is absurd and heightened enough that you almost can't get back there. And then if you go into some of the dark family drama, and we had darker stuff originally in some of the scenes and darker beats and moments, and we had to actually carve some of those things out because and eliminate them even because they ultimately weren't important to tell the core story and make the point of the ups and downs of this family that we wanted to explore. And also the deeper, a darker valley we went into with the drama, it was so much harder to get back out into one of those comic scenes.
Yeah, just jumping tones.
Exactly. It started to feel too swinging too wildly, like a pendulum between those. So part of the trick was to try to smooth that out and try to find a way to also just have each scene have a certain level, core level of authenticity that we could believe that some of these absurd comic things were really ultimately, as crazy as they are, could happen in the real world. You know, ultimately, is it possible that this could happen? This sort of staggerly, you know, wild thing that happens. And we wanted to at least keep it in the realm where it's like, okay, technically, yes, this is possible. This could happen. I mean, there have been stories of authors, you know, these alter egos that have been found out later. And, you know, that has all happened in the real book world. All the different tones that we went into, we wanted them to feel real.
Well, it's such a great contrast when he's in the car with Issa Rae. It seems really close to the scene where the woman's reading her book. And you're struck with the contrast of here's the way Black people are portrayed as speaking, and yet here they are in this beautiful car with leather seats having a very universal conversation between brother and sister, and it's not like that. You know, he's seeing that the culture is being fed an image that he's not seeing in his own life.
Yeah, exactly. In a hopefully not too didactic way, you can allow the audience to understand that too and allow the audience to just feel how frustrating it is for Monk to have his work be perceived because of certain external characteristics or something. And you can illustrate that just through watching these very simple, normal, sort of basic family drama scenes.
Temp music was all kind of a type, kind of jazz, piano. Did you temp with the actual music or did it change or what did you use for temp?
No, we temped with vintage jazz, which was difficult. But
oh man, editing wise.
Oh my God, I can't even tell you. I mean, I really spent.
I don't want to think about that.
Spent so many hours in the chair just working on music editing. There were a few weeks where we're, you know, getting ready for screenings or whatever. Yeah, that was a lot of the work I was doing. But you know, with a character named Thelonious Ellison and his nickname is Monk, it was clear. I mean, Cord knew right from the get-go that, of course, that was the kind of tone that he wanted to go for musically. Luckily, my dad is a major jazz head. He has like 5,000 jazz records in his house. Not an exaggeration. Like, he literally has 5,000 jazz records in his house.
Oh my gosh.
So I grew up with jazz and classical are actually like pretty much the only music that was ever played in my house when I was growing up. Not that Cord knew this when he hired me, but it happened to be this great crossover that I just happened to have a lot of that music in my head from at a kind of deep level, genetically almost. It was a challenge, but it was so fun to cut with that music and to try to find the right cues at different moments. It's never going to work fully for a movie, of course, because this movie also has some elements that are very classical to it, the romance and the drama, and it needed score in different moments, but it needed a score that could be both jazzy and reflect a little bit of Western canonical classic film music score. And our composer, Laura, really was able to work in both of those modes or find a way to meld them together even, which was great. That was really wonderful when we started working with her. And her music editor, Alex Levy, is also a genius, I just want to say. And so working with both of them was really tremendous because then finally we were able to give the movie what it really, really needed. All of the things that we worked so hard at and struggled with of this high wire act of tone straddling in picture was what we also, of course, needed to do with music and with the score. And so Alex and Laura and I at the late stages and even on the mix stage were kind of working on that together. Our composer, Laura, would have this wild setup at her studio where she has these dense mattresses on the floor that I think she deliberately puts them that way so that her director and producers and editor are on a level, one level lower than her. So that we're looking up at her as she's playing cues and auditioning them for us. But yeah, we had some great moments there. I remember there was a really wonderful moment where I could not express how to talking about music is hard, you know, and how to give my note on a cue without just getting up and dancing, you know? So I was like, look, Laura, she's a very kind of groovy lady who immediately got what I was going for. But I was like, I just have to stand up and I have to dance out this note. I think you're going to understand. Because like the vibe and the rhythm that I thought we needed, I could show her better with my body than I could trying to come up with some sentence about it. And then she just watched me.
Wow.
Okay. And went over to her piano bench and just kind of looked at me and started improvising on the keys. I mean, no, it was just so fun. It was great. It was.
I hope somebody recorded that on video and you can send it to me.
I'm afraid I haven't seen the video. My producer Nikos claims that he does have some video evidence of it, and I'm not sure if I ever want that to get out in the world.
I'm sure, but if you think about it and you want this to be the place to reveal it, you can definitely call me up and say, Steve, here it is.
Oh my God. I'm going to get it from Nikos first. Let me look at it. Yeah, but he told me he did have this. Oh my God.
There's a famous quote, which I swear is Steve Martin, but he probably stole it from someplace else. It's something about talking about music is like dancing about architecture.
Oh yeah, yeah, yes. I remember hearing that at some point years ago, yeah.
You danced your musical note. I love it. That
dance
works.
The note, exactly.
Do you have any muses?
Yeah. Recently, I was listening to an interview on the radio with this woman who is a classicist and an academic and a translator of the Odyssey and the Iliad. And I was drawing these crazy connections between what she does and what we do as editors. Hearing her, I felt this really keen identification with her that I think any editor would be able to relate to, which is she was talking about translating the Iliad and how she can't do a direct translation from the Greek. Like, that's of no use to anyone. She has the original text and we have our screenplays, you know, and she then needs to stanza by stanza. And for us, I think it's beat by beat. She needs to take whatever the feeling was supposed to be the feeling that is given in the Greek, the intent of the original Greek. She needs to take what Homer was trying to say, and then she needs to find the right way to translate it. And hearing her talk about it was, I realized that I was listening to an artist, that it's not a simple thing to translate the Iliad, not that anybody would think it was, but that I was listening to an artist talk about her work in the way that we as editors do all of this translating too, that, you know, we have this guide of what's on the page that sometimes, and in this case, luckily was fantastic, you know, a great screenplay, but then you're given this raw material and you have to kind of really spend time working out what is this going to feel like for the audience? And every emotional beat, whether it's supposed to be comedic or sad or sweet or romantic, it's up to us ultimately to be these kind of divining rods and translate the moment. You know, the footage has to kind of go through us and then come out the other side when we put it together. It has to come out as a new form. I guess it's sort of that final rewrite thing again, that maxim. But I just thought it's so interesting that a woman who translates classical literature, you know, from Greek into English, hearing her talk about her work was the closest I've come to recognizing what it is that editors do, which is so strange and funny, because it's not direct writing, but it's a form of rewriting. It's a translation. It's finding the emotion and the tone and finding the way to give that to the audience.
It's not a word-for-word translation, which wouldn't give you the feeling. It might be more technically correct, but it doesn't emote the same.
Yeah, it doesn't evoke the same feelings. And so, yeah, I just realized it's just such an interesting thought I had this week of that she's, what she does is like what we do. We have all these images, but we have to find a way with music and sound design and repurposing footage and looks sometimes and altering time and space in a scene, you know, that we do all these things to translate something. But all that translation is to be true to the original intent of the author, of course.
That's so, you know, it's very interesting. And I can see it also, even in script, in the writing by somebody like Cord, that he maybe wrote a scene in a specific way to evoke a certain feeling. And then when he shot it, maybe it didn't quite happen. So you have to get back to the original feeling through the editing.
Exactly. That's our job, of course. I mean, it's why it is just what we do. But that process is such an interesting creative one, because it's kind of very intellectual on one hand. And then on another hand, it's mechanical, you know, what we do in the Avid, you know, and then it's auditory and it's musical and it's rhythmic. It's hard to talk about our art and what we do with non-editors, but I think editors will understand we're just playing with all these different tools simultaneously and somehow keeping all the plates up in the air. But it's ultimately just the ultimate magic trick of manipulating people. I mean, that's what our job is to do and to translate that feeling.
It was so nice to talk to you.
Oh,
and
me too.
Congratulations on a great film.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I just saw that you were at least mentioned in the wrap with
2023
being the year of female editors. So congratulations on being up there with Oppenheimer and Killers of the
Maestro,
Flower Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. I know.
Thelma. You and Thelma
Queen.
In the same article.
Oh my God. I know. No, pinch me. It's a dream.
That's it for Art of the Cup this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Hilda Brazola, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hulfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.